Lauren L. from San Diego.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, everybody. I want to welcome the new people and the out-of-towners. Welcome, Sierra from Arizona. And thanks, Andrea, for your 10-minute share. We spent 3.5 hours today doing a fifth step together. And so I knew we were doing that. And so when they said, hey, do you know of anyone who wants to do a 10-minute speaker? I'm like, well, we're doing a fifth step on Saturday. I can't imagine a more fun thing that Andrea would want to do than come be 10-minute speaker. Like, that is going to be, like, the best. Because, like, it's already been, like, through all the crap. So it's like, whatever. Let's stand and talk in front of people. And so thank you. You did an excellent job. And that was our first time ever doing something like this in front of a group like, you know, this many people, you know. And so that's pretty freaking cool. So right on, you know. And how eloquent was that? You just were amazing. And thank you. And I want to thank you for my watch. This gentleman here has lent me his watch for the evening. I'm really happy. And if you're not, if you're here and you're not, absolutely fine. I went to plenty of meetings at various times in my life. My sobriety is November 28th, 2005. I got sober when I was 26 years old. And I'm 36 today. And I did not like coming to meetings all those times. I'm not happy all those times. But I came anyways. And the rewards that I received, not just from that action, but from everyone around me doing that same action, have been something I cannot place a value on. It's just invaluable. And the most important thing is some of the ladies that are joining me here tonight. And I'm grateful for that because I'm happy and I get to have this happy tribe of people around me as well. So I guess that makes me grateful, too. I'm going to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I love everything about alcohol. I think alcohol, to this day, I think it's the neatest thing out there. I think drugs are absolutely fantastic. If I could use them and drink and have no consequences, you would have another speaker because I had a ton of fun. The first time I ever drank wasn't substantial. It wasn't like it was like, oh, wow, you know, rainbow shot out. But what I had was a fine time. I had a fine time, and I laughed a lot. And if alcohol still did that for me, and if alcohol did not betray me or do crazy things to my body and my mind and my heart and my soul and the people around me and the facial expressions, then you'd have another speaker because I see nothing wrong with it. But I have alcoholism, I have spiritual malady, I have something that a pill does not fix, and I have something that the longer I stay sober, the less I'm remembering how uncomfortable that is. I mean, I can remember that they happened, but I don't actually recall how it felt, which is why it's so important that I stay involved here and do what I do. And I'm the middle of three girls. My father was a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserves. My mom was a teacher. She went back to school when we were kids, and she got her master's degree, and she got her credential, and she was the first person on her side, first person anybody in our family that had gotten higher education. And it was, you know, my mom's a stellar woman. And it had love been enough, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. Love's not enough. Family's not enough. It's not that way, you know. I was born at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And you know, like wanting to have a family, you know, good people. I have a little sister. I have an older sister. We fought like cats and dogs growing up, you know, that kind of stuff. But we moved to California, and I went to school here in San Diego. And, it's very square, you know, went to church, that kind of stuff. But what ended up happening is there was some violence in my home. My mom is a rageaholic. Neither of my parents drank. Mom's also, what do you call a person that holds every pack rat? You know, and you got everything in the house. So there's always a lot of chaos in my home, a lot of fights, some insanity. And my older sister got involved with some drug stuff, and she was in and out of rehab a couple times before I was 15, 16. And I remember one time in particular, she stole my shoes, and she sold them to her drug dealer. And I was very upset about that. And so we got into a fight in class in high school. And there was just kind of insanity. And here's my thinking. My thinking is I don't like being told what to do. And I also didn't like authority. And so what I would do is all the stuff was going on. And so my solution to that was I would skip school and do my own thing. And if I'd spent the entire day writing a doctor's note to get out of school then and forging it, you know, then that was a fine day spent because I'd rather spend my time doing that than being told what to do. That's just my thinking. That's my self-reliance. That's Lauren doing Lauren. And I did that kind of stuff. But then it got a little weird and crazy. And so I had a power of suggestion. I saw my friend's boyfriend move to Santa Barbara, and he went to Santa Barbara City College, and he moved there and lived in the dorms, which they had, which is kind of a unique thing because usually they don't have that for City College. Usually you just go to City College and you just do their own thing. But this I could sell to my parents because I went to school. Since I was in high school, I was a fine student. I didn't blow it off other than the things that they didn't know about, which is I had my older sister's expired military ID that said she was 18, and so I could go to the bars in Tijuana, and I would do that on, like, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and I'd go to school the next day, and it was fine. And they didn't know that kind of stuff, though. And so I sold them on this idea, and I moved to Santa Barbara in 1997 when I was 17 years old. And that was to kind of get me away from that other insanity with my older sister, and my baby sister was just, you know, poor thing was just, like, 6 years younger than me, so she stayed home. And I found my like fellows. Has anyone ever been to Isla Vista? And welcome. You know, it's like if you know it, you know it. So if you've seen the cartoon Pinocchio, and all the little boys go to this island where there's a carnival, and the longer they're there, they start sprouting an ear, and they sprout a tail, and they're becoming jackasses. And that is what Isla Vista is like. The longer you stay there, the more it sucks you in. And it's 1 square mile, and it's all college students, and all anyone does is drink. And they party, and there's a lot of City College students that were like me, and they sold their parents on the idea. Because I didn't take the SATs, I didn't prepare myself for life like that. What I had was survival skills, like forging doctor's notes. That's my skill. So flash forward to however many years. I think I was going to college for 6 years, and it was time to have... I had transferred to UCSB, and I wasn't prepared to do that. I'd gotten there just because they guarantee you that you'll go after a number of years. And the hard part with that is you have to actually show up to class and have to study outside of the classroom, and you have to do work that I just don't have those kind of skills. You know, you can't forge a doctor's note out of that. You can't, or can you? And that was my solution. It was time to graduate, and I was not there. In fact, I was on academic probation because I'd gotten so many Fs. And what they had said is, I had a special meeting with the people because they were going to kick me out. And I said, okay, so you all can see me now. I have the same face then that I had now. I have dimples. I have, you know, bright smile. I'm like, can you please let me walk the line? And I promise I will come back and retake those classes. And it was a bold-faced lie. It was just, let me do what I want to do. And they said, okay, well, we'll let you walk at this certain time, but you can't walk at this other ceremony with these other kids because for various reasons I wasn't allowed to do that. So I'm like, okay, well, thank you very much. But I have a solution to that, and I forged a note. I forged the card, and it was not computerized or anything then. So we were just getting email when I was doing this. So I was like, I can walk the line when I want to walk, and that's what I did. I was drinking PBR, and I sat in front of the computer, and I walked the line. And I took that photo. I shook this hand, took the diploma with that hand, and I never went back. And I drank on that for a number of years because my grandparents were there. My great-grandmother, who lived to be 102 years old, you know, she's flying in from San Antonio when she was like 90. Granny Wheeler is in Santa Barbara for my graduation. That's legitimately her name. And my cousin and his girlfriend and my aunt and my uncle and everybody's there. And I have to keep up appearances, and that's what I had to do. And that'll come back later. So... I had a number of things happen. Mind you, I haven't talked a lot about my drinking. Really, what I'm describing is my thinking. And I had a number of things happen in my life. All of them could have been determined as a serious bottom. You know, near misses, chances. I considered myself to be incredibly lucky at the time. Now I'm not quite sure if I believe in luck. But I had all kinds of things happen to me, and I never found myself in these rooms. I never found myself with that DUI. I never found myself with that minor in possession. I never found myself with that drunk in public. I never found myself caught one more time because I just got very, very lucky. But I drank in that town for 10 years. And that's, I guess, like 8 years, just to be honest. So I found myself in another relationship. And that's what I did, is I went from relationship to relationship to relationship. And none of them were honest, and there was always overlap. I think you know what I mean. And he'd said to me something that was really definitive. And his exact words to me were, "Lauren, I'm sick of watching you drink to kill yourself unless you stop. I'm out of here." I'd gotten all kinds of things. I've gotten mixed messages over the years. You know, I'm a wet-the-bed alcoholic. I've gotten messages like that, you know, and with people in the bed that are like, not okay. And but I could reason my way out of that, you know. My personal favorite was food poisoning or roofied. Now, neither of those ever happened to me. But I did pay someone for roofies once, and I did take roofies knowingly multiple times, and I was like, you don't have to slip them to me. I will take them. You know, this is the goal. And I was never – I know, honey, I know. The goal was always to get gone. And I have a lot of levity about it, but it was kind of a dark time because it wasn't – I remember I stared straight in my coffee cup, and it's described in the big book as frothy emotional appeal. Someone said to me, "I love you. Please change." And I didn't have any words or any tools to be able to say anything other than staring into my frothy cup, "I'm sorry. You're right. I can change." I wasn't sorry. I didn't care if he was right or not, and I didn't want to change. But I don't have the words to say that. What's coming out of my mouth is just like, "I'm sorry. You're right." And I had no problem saying, "I'm sorry," you know. But he didn't know things like forging my documents to graduate from college. You know, he didn't know that I was lying to my job, that they thought I'd finished and I really hadn't. He didn't know about just, you know, the way my brain worked in this double life is that I knew I drank differently. I knew that I was secretive. I knew that I had this double life. I identify with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in the big book. I remember I was sponsoring a girl up in a recovery house in Santa Barbara, and she was like, who's Dr. Jekyll? Who's Mr. Hyde? And I was like, oh, that's a legitimate question. You're like 19 years old. You wouldn't know that, you know. And it was true. You know, I have memories of black and white movies and of this, you know, like these men in trench coats and gutters and this is what I thought an alcoholic was. I thought that it was this like flasher, psychotic variable. And so we were breaking it down. I'm like, well, he was the doctor, and then when he took this potion, he turned into Mr. Hyde, and he did things he didn't remember the next day. And it was a social phenomenon when this play came out, and it was a book, and blah, blah, blah. And she's just like, and you identified with that? And I was like, I know, just take my word for it. Like, just believe me, I was two different people. And bottom line, I was just the same Lauren that you see standing in front of you today is a whole person. Back before I determined what the heck was going on with my life, because I truly didn't know, I had two people. It was like flipping a switch. It was two sides of a coin. There was Lauren sober, agitated, irritable, half-assing life, and there was Lauren drunk, who was trying always to get gone. You know, that's just the best way I can describe it. You know, there wasn't an in-between. And I couldn't talk to my mom on Mother's Day. They were living in Virginia later on. And I'd call her only when I was drunk because I didn't want to talk to her when I was sober. And I had girlfriends that wouldn't talk to me on the phone because they'd hear two words out of my mouth and they knew that I was thick-tongued and drunk. And they wouldn't talk to me. So he said those things and I heard it. And I got drunk that day at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the next day was my birthday. And so, of course, I got drunk that day. And I blacked out and I passed out and I peed somewhere. And I woke up and he was gone and he was mad. And he was like, "I meant what I said and I'm out of here." And those are the kind of consequences that I had someone tell all my secrets to my face about me. And I hated that. I had, like I said, I had all kind of other things happen to me. But that, for some reason, I heard because this was a guy who drank as my drinking buddy. I dated someone who was sober, ostensibly, because the only reason why I drank so much was because I had bad influences around me. And so if I dated someone who didn't drink, then I would then behave better. And that wasn't the case. I was drunk a lot, and he was not okay with that. And we broke up. And it was a fiery breakup, and it was bad. And so this guy's my drinking buddy, so I believed him. And that was actually the first touch. Oh, I'll tell you what happened. Is he dated somebody for a long time. She was 7 years sober in Los Angeles, and she was an actress. And so she had to she had a whirling till of sponsees, and they'd crash on their sofa sometimes. And he said to me, "Lauren, you look like this girl's sponsees." And I knew all about her, and I was just like, oh, my God. Like, these are things that I couldn't get around. So, and he moved out and broke up, and he dumped me. And I was just like, look at that. You know, like, look at this consequence. But more than that, And this is what's really important that I can't forget, is that I didn't care if I lived or if I died. Now, I'd fantasize about how to die. I'd fantasize about killing myself, but I never did it because I always wanted it to be an accident. Because I had this, like, idea in my head that I couldn't, like, actually pull the trigger because I was a victim, and I was sensitive, and I was unique and special. And one day, it's just like, one day my movie montage will happen. You know what I'm talking about? When all of a sudden there's like a series of music and the main character, all these great things happen in his or her life. And at the very end, they feel victorious, you know? And I kept waiting for my music montage to happen. And I'd fantasize about these kind of things. And it's important to remember that on the last day that I drank, not only did I not care if I lived or if I died, I couldn't even cry. I stared in front of a mirror and I had my shirt off, and I could trace every blue vein from the center of my chest all the way out to the ends of my arms, and I was completely see-through, and I felt nothing. And I don't know what's worse, is to feel flatline or to feel sad, but I felt nothing. And so I came here sweetly reasonable. I called a friend of mine who suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, and she suggested it because she was a year sober in another 12-step program in Northern California. And that's how I came to you. I emailed Central Office to find a meeting, and I emailed them because I couldn't say, "My name's Lauren, alcoholic." I could not say those words. Like, it wasn't going to come out of my mouth, you know? Like, I wasn't just going to say, like, "Hey, I know what my problem is." What I was going to say was, perhaps I could try this and they could tell me, "Lauren, not you." You know what I mean? Like, "Well, I'm glad you're here, but I don't think you really fit in." And, you know, I would kind of, because I was just very anxious. I felt like maybe there was a pill for me. I had very high anxiety. And it turns out that drinking caused anxiety. I didn't know those things. I sat around and I would have feelings like, well, if I'm enjoying drinking, then I'm not really controlling it. And if I'm controlling my drinking, then I'm not really enjoying it. And I never found a balance between that. So what I did is I broke it down into small sections. And this is how I came to my first meeting. Tim W. emailed me right back within a couple of hours, and he gave me meeting suggestions. That was very disappointing because I didn't really technically want to go. And I pulled up to the church and I parked. And I had to tell myself that if I found a parking spot that I would park in it. And I told myself that if I found the address, I'd walk towards the building. And I told myself that if I found the building, I'd look for the door. And if I found the door, I'd just go in. I mean, it had to be like, you know, when you go through really hard times in life and you can't really look at the big picture, because if I look at the big picture, it's just going to freaking kill me. But I can look at small sections at a time. And I looked at moment by moment by moment, and I walked in the door and I sat in a chair, and it was a women's meeting. And they went around the room. For some reason, it just brings back a lot of memories, but they sat around the room and they went in a circle and they said their name and their illness. And I said, "My name is Lauren and I don't know what I am." And I sat there and I cried because not only, I heard what was read. I heard this thing, and there's an exclamation point published in chapter 5, and it says, "There is one power, that one is God. May you find him now." We don't usually enunciate that exclamation point, and they didn't there. For some reason, I heard it. I heard, "There is one power, that one is God. May you find him now." I did not come here with a higher power. I came here with the antithesis of that. I came here with the idea that if you had a higher power, you were weaker for having had it. I'm sorry for you. The reality of that is what I believe to be my experience, and that is that great men have faith, and it takes courage. And that type of thing is what I have found here. But anyways, I sat in that meeting, and I got my first big book. It was a soft cover. It fell apart. This lady told me her higher power was her cat. It was very weird. But no, this is just like an example. You're going to get a wide swath of life. You know, you're going to come to AA, and it's not going to be everything. I stand here wearing a skirt dressed appropriately because I desire to have that message that was so freely given to me passed on to you. I had like a rigorous form of Alcoholics Anonymous shown to me. And yeah, there were ladies with their cats. And yeah, there was people that were telling me things like, you know, just don't drink no matter what. And I was just like, you know, it reminded me of my coffee cup moment, staring in there like, "I'm sorry, you're right, I can change." That was as effective as that. It was like, whatever. I needed a sufficient substitute, kind of like what Andrew described so well, is that feeling of camaraderie and joyousness here is that sufficient substitute. Like, I needed that. I didn't stop drinking because I wanted life to suck. I stopped drinking because I wanted to have freedom, and that's what I found. It didn't happen right away. It didn't happen right away. They describe our adventures before and after. The big book suggests that I'm going to have adventures before, which I had plenty of. Ask anyone I've ever sponsored. They'll be like, "Lauren, shut up. We've heard all of your experience before." You know, but the adventures after. Because stopping drinking just means the power's been shut off, but the blades of the fan still spin, you know? Like, it's still going. Centrifugal motion, like, it's happening in my life. And I don't know how to have correct behavior. I don't know how to chit-chat. I don't know how to not drink. I don't know how to keep going to meetings. The word commitment, like, show up for, like, and the ones in the meetings where I got sober, commitments were for a year. Here, and every once in a while, you'll hear, like, you'd heard of a meeting, like my women's meeting up there. They'd gotten to down to 6 months, and they were like, oh, that meeting's gone on to 6 month commitments. Good luck to them. You know, because they, like, people were expected to show up for a whole year, you know, and I was just like, dude, let's get through Christmas, okay? It's like, it was Thanksgiving time. Like, I had my last drunk Thanksgiving, and I was sponsorless because I couldn't do it right, and it was like asking somebody on a date, and I was trying to get him back, and I was going to Texas to visit my family, and I was lying to them. I don't know, I was trying to stop drinking, and just the blades of the fan were still spinning. But what settled down was I fell into a group of people who worked the steps out of the big book. I went to women's meetings, I went to big book studies, I went to speaker meetings. And I had, this is what my sobriety has looked like, go to a book study and have, actually I didn't actually have a commitment at a book study, but I'd do H&I and have a commitment at H&I, go to my women's meeting and have a commitment there, and go to a speaker meeting, a formal structured speaker meeting where one has to greet, or one has to do treasury, or one has to do things like pick up chairs or make coffee, or, I mean, there's literally 100 tasks that go into putting on a meeting this size. And it's funny, I look back on that and I think like 10% of the meeting are doing 90% of the work. But those are the people that are staying sober. And not just the kind of grumpy sober. They're like that happy, free, like irritating sober, you know? And it's, you know, that's okay. I don't judge. I don't judge because that's me. And I heard they had speakers come up from Los Angeles, and I traveled all over the place, and I had this big, huge life as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, working the steps, and just, I mean, happy, joyous, and free doesn't even begin to describe it. However, about 6 months sober, I felt like I'd overreacted. I remember looking around the rooms, and the lights were a little fluorescent, and the chairs were a little uncomfortable, and the gentlemen were a little too old. No, nothing personal, but they weren't my age, and I had an interest in that. And but what I had done is they'd gone on a raft. There was a rafting trip that was being planned, and I'd put $100 down on this rafting trip when I was 5 months sober. And then that was the first deposit, and the second deposit would be like $50 or something. And so when I'm looking around at 6 months, I was like, man, if I drink, then I lose this $100 that I put on this rafting trip, because it'd be really awkward to go on this trip if I'm drinking on the sober AA camping trip. And so I didn't drink that week. I didn't drink the next week. And lo and behold, all of a sudden I had 7 months. And lo and behold, that joyousness returned. And I found that there's like this pace at like 30 days. I look back and I'm like, wow, you felt a little edgy at 30 days too. And at 60 days and 90 days and at 6 months and at 9 months. And then right before I turned one, there were all times where I was like, these freaking fluorescent lights. And I remember I used my phone in the meeting once, and the meeting was about to start, and this guy with a lot of time came over and he tapped on it, and he's just like, you should be in the meeting. And he touched my phone. And he didn't do anything, like, but he touched it. And I was like, I hate him, and I hope he dies. And I was like the most sincere form of hate, to be like, don't you know who I am? And don't you know that I forged doctor's notes? And I'm like this like amazing person. And I remember, oh, I can tell you what happened. The reason why I got asked to speak here tonight is because I sat in this meeting like 3 weeks ago in the back, and I was talking shit. I was talking badly about the meeting in the back row. And I was being like, I miss my old timers. You know, this guy, he was at the podium and he was wearing a hat. And if it was in my meeting, you know what they yell from the back? They go, we can't see you, take off your hat. That's the kind of stuff I was raised in. You know, gentlemen had to take their hat off if they were to be up here. And I know it's not for everybody, and that's okay. But for me, like, I couldn't even make chit-chat with somebody. I couldn't go on a job interview. I certainly couldn't go back to college and retake those classes and see those professors again that I lied to. But I could see someone with a commitment put money in the basket, show up every single week, and then count the money and honestly turn it over to the meeting and pay rent. And that meant way more to me. And then I would see somebody humble themselves and take their hat off and be like, I might have hat here, but here I am. You know what I mean? And I was just like, a lot of times people come to AA and they're looking, you know, for a connection with other people. Maybe it's with opposite sex. Maybe it's with the same sex. But you know what's the most attractive thing to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is someone who works a good program. You know, if you're interested in somebody, work a good program. You know, how big is your God? That's a good program. You know, that kind of stuff works. So the longer I stayed sober, the more things came up in my life. And as it was described so well, it's like you don't just get sober and things get easy. They don't get fun. It's not walking through daisies. It's uncomfortable. It's awkward. There's moments where you're going to look around and you just this be like, how is me going to this meeting going to fix my relationship problem? Or how is me going to this meeting going to fix my problem with my stepkid? Or how is me going to this meeting going to fix this problem with my employer where I hate them and they clearly are out to get me? You know, but it's this... Man, I couldn't remember the word the other day either, but it's... I do something over here on the left, and over here on the right, my life changes. It's a tenuous connection. If you remember the word, please shout it out. Well, there's a certain word for it. It's going to come to me at the very end, I'm sure of it. But what I found is I showed up over here, and I went to coffee with the women from the meeting on my left. And over here on the right, I had less anxiety in the workplace. Over here on one side, I'm like of service, thinking of others. Even in the most slightest way of, do you need a ride to the meeting? Offering that. When I'm having a bad day, so therefore I call this person, don't talk about myself. Instead, ask them if they want to ride to a meeting. And they say, yes, I pick them up. We talk about them the whole time. I get to the meeting and I am right as rain. I've done nothing about my situation. But I had problems that died of neglect. I'm going to tell you that I reconnected with that guy, the one that I dated before I got sober. And I reconnected with him, and it was really neat because I had really screwed up in that area of my life. He had a daughter. She was 8 years old when I met her. I was the only girl that he'd ever introduced to her. And she was 9 when I left him. And I didn't just leave him a little bit. I left him in one of those, like, I'm never seeing you again, tumbleweed alcoholic goodbyes, where you don't say goodbye. You just, like, get out of a moving truck. You know, and that's what I did. We were at a stoplight. I was pissed off. I was drunk. We rolled to a stop, and I got out, and I'm like, I'm walking home, and you don't tell me what to do. You know, like, I'm very friendly. And he didn't know that we were breaking up. And we broke up, and I got a new boyfriend, and I moved into his house the very next week. And I had and he drank, and that's the guy that eventually told me, I'm sick of watching you drink to kill yourself, and I'm out of here. Okay, so if there's not a God out there, I don't know what is. That guy's an AA. And you want to know a bad day is when you're sitting, I sat in my Saturday night meeting in Santa Barbara, and here comes this guy walking in wearing a tie to take his cake. And he's sober another year, and I'm standing up as a newcomer, and I'm like, oh, this is how this is going to work. Like, it was just a bad day. And I hear a little bit of identification. Anyways, I behaved myself, and I didn't say anything, and I stood up as a new person, and I never want to do that again because it's the hardest thing ever to stand up as a new person, and it is difficult, and I kept coming to meetings, and eventually, I don't think I was about a year sober yet, but I remember I would lay in bed and I would pray because I missed that little girl, and I missed the life that I had touched on, and I would pray, like, God, please, if there's a way I could get back in our life again, if there's a way that I could see this little girl again and I could fix that situation, please let me. And I was very hopeful in my sobriety as I was getting, like, 90 days, and I was getting 5 months, and I was getting time, and I was like, could this be? Like, is this something that would be granted for me? I don't know. And that was able to happen. You know, he was able to kind of let me back in again, even though I'd really, like, just barbecued that area. Because you want to mess with somebody, mess with their kid. I mean, am I right? You know, it wasn't like, can't wait to have you come over again. It's like, no, freaking earn it. And I did, because I showed up consistently. And then, you know, when I was 13 when I married him, and I got to be your stepmom. And that relationship didn't work out. It was really difficult. It was hard for us to do that, but we did everything we could, you know. And it was really difficult to tell this little kid when she was 16 years old that I was moving out. And told her I was getting a divorce. If you have the opportunity to be a step parent, if you have the opportunity to be the life of someone else who is a significant other who has a child, maybe you have a child and you have someone in your life that you're trying to have them merge, this blended family lifestyle, I don't think anybody is free from that. I don't think anybody walked around and been like, yep, no problems there. But if you have that opportunity, I implore you, I was not the most important person in that relationship. The child was. And that's what I learned. I am, to my core, selfish and self-seeking. I don't know any other way. Those are my reflexes. If I were to act like, if I had the reflex that I want to get out of bed every morning and I cannot wait to face life, you know, I would be nuts. I get up out of bed every morning and go like, no, I want to go back to sleep. That alarm clock is literally the worst sound I've ever heard in my entire life. And I don't want to brush my teeth either, and I also don't want to pay my rent. Those are the things that are my natural inclinations. I do not want to do those things. But if you have the opportunity, like I have had, to kind of write that area where you could try to be perhaps somewhat of normalcy and consistency in a child's life where there's been chaos and drama, it's a golden opportunity. For me, it was half of the responsibility and none of the authority. And it was like paying money that I thought would be coming to me is going to go to this kid too. And it's like, oh, I guess I agreed to do that, huh? Like, you know, where the rubber meets the road. It's like, how do I behave in that area? And I went back to school, and I was a stepmom, and I was a wife, and I guess I still am a stepmom. I'm going to tell you about going back to school. After I got a divorce in 2012, my stepdaughter would meet me every Thursday morning before school on her late start. And we would get breakfast before school. And it was wonderful that she was willing to do that. Because I don't know about you, but when I was 17 years old, I was not interested in getting up not a minute earlier before school. But her dad encouraged it. Her mom encouraged it. Her stepdad encouraged it. And so we were still able to do that. And I knew that it was time for me to go back to UCSB and to tell them that I was ready to make that amends. I was ready to say, I'm sorry, it was wrong of me, I lied to you, will you please give me the opportunity to retake these classes and pay you all this freaking money for tuition? I didn't say that, but I was like, please, will you let me? And they said yes. They said that, and they had to dig my file out of the freaking paper thing, because now everything's electronic, and I had to sit there and tell like four different people how wrong I was. And I had to tell four different people that I'm now sober, in recovery, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I had to show up for the classes and actually make good on those payments. And that was really important to me because I'd broken my anonymity, and I might be the only walking big book that these people ever see in this professional capacity. And so I need not do it again. And so I had to show up, and I had to be with kids who were 18 and 19 years old who were just like me, and they were totally self-absorbed. And these kids are like on Paris Hilton on their laptops, and their dad bought them. And I'm going like, I just paid $6,000 for this class, and I cannot see. Will you please move your freaking computer? But I'm going to be nice. You know, like these are things. It's like I struggled, but I got all A's in those classes, and I was able to finish school, and I was able to have an honest degree, and I knew that I wanted to move back to San Diego for various reasons, which I'll get to. But there's something else that's really important I need to talk about too, which is this girl I sponsored. She went back to school too, and right after I finished, she was legitimately graduating. She was literally walking the line as an honest person. And I'd sponsored her from the beginning, and here she was 5 years sober, and she was doing that. And I remember sitting there in the audience, and her parents were loaded. And they missed the procession because they were gone somewhere doing what we do. And I sat in my seat, and I looked, and I was just crying because here I didn't walk the line honestly, but here I had been of service to somebody else who was. And I, at that point, was finishing my stuff, but there was no pomp and circumstance because it was literally just like checking off the box and saying, you've retaken it, you're done. And it was because her success that I felt success, you know? And that's that tenuous connection I was referring to, is that I'm helping someone over here, and over here I'm closing the gap on this shame and this guilt that I'd carried for a long time. And I did all kinds of other things that were wrong or dishonest that I had to make amends for, with ex-boyfriends and people and that little kid and my parents and financial stuff. But that I had, it's very rare that I have like a face-to-face, like, this is the evidence of work, you know? And it's like God, that divinity of a higher power. And then I also had this thing happen. So my older sister, I mentioned that she was going in and out of recovery. No, she's going out of rehab. Well, I was 2 years sober, and I was making living amends to my parents, and they had moved to now, they were now in Alabama. We were big, like, nomad military family. So now they're in Alabama, and I'm, like, going to go visit them to be present, because my biggest issue was I was a very absent and dishonest child. I did not show up for things. If I did show up for them, I was drunk. I had Christmas morning, I'd have a beer in a plastic cup that looked like I was having like orange juice, and they didn't know. And it was always this very, like, I remember I babysat my nephew, and I would like be so in a blackout that I would like drop him. I mean, bad stuff. And so I show up to Huntsville, and I brought my little sister with me as a surprise. And we flew into Birmingham, and we road tripped. And, you know, you can sing that song, Sweet Home Alabama, over and over and over again when you're in Alabama, and it's pretty fun. So we're making a good time of it. So my little sister, it's really applicable sometimes. Life is sweet. So we roll into Huntsville, and I got my sister's, my older sister's there, my little sister's there, I'm there. We're like, surprise, Mom and Dad, you know, we were coming. And they're like, what are you doing here? And it's like, this is great. And I watched my older sister, and I watched her. Oh, by the way, I want to tell you that I got her permission to tell you this story tonight, because she's not here in this room, and that would be unfair. She lives here in San Diego. Maybe you know her. I don't know. She took two Vicodin, a shot of NyQuil, and drank a Corona, and it was like 11 a.m., and she's like, I'm going to take a nap. And I'm like, not bad. You know, I'm like, that sounds like a fantastic nap. And and I remember I was doing dishes, or she was doing my mom's hair, or we're just going through the motions of life. And after that trip, she had a lot of crazy things happen in her life, but she called me and she's like, you were around Mom. How were you normal? And I was like, okay, well, the reason I wasn't angry with her is because that's just me working a program, which I tried to talk to her about, but wasn't something she was, you know, it's as if you hear, people would talk to me and I would hear nothing until I was ready to hear it. And, so she drove to central office. And the central office here in Mission Valley, and I wasn't living here at the time, and so when I go there, I volunteer there on occasion, and now when I go there, bless you, I look around and I go like, no crap, this was the same one my sister was driving to 8 years ago. You know, I'm looking around, because she's going to be 8 years sober in June, and it's wonderful to have a sober family member. It's also really fun to be like the younger sibling and to have more time than the older sibling. It's just like, girl, it's been a long time in life and I am like so happy that you finally figured yourself out and I'm the one in charge. You know, it's like, but no, character defects need to stay at bay. I've had spiritual experiences of the educational variety. It's described in the appendices. It's described in Appendix 2. And, shortly after that trip and some various other things that happened, my dad visited San Diego. I had a wonderful blessing of spending the weekend with him. And we did everything that you would want to do with a family. I had just gotten engaged. There was a lot of fun things going on. And he flew home and he had a heart attack and he passed away. And my dad didn't just die a little bit. He died and it was a fissure in my family. It was something where he was the glue that held it all together because my mom was a nut. Okay, well, I love my mother, but my mom was unsustainable in her actions. And I wanted more of my dad in my life. I wanted more. But I remember having to go to his funeral, and I remember flying back into Huntsville and sitting there across from his casket and looking at the wrinkles in his ears and thinking to myself, like, this is not life. I did not get sober for this. This was 2009. It's 2016. So I was 4 years sober. And I remember being at his funeral, and I had to conduct myself the same way as if I was at an AA meeting because my feet were trained to be able to stand here in front of you and deliver a eulogy. I could deliver a eulogy for my dad. And I could be there and have it not be about me. How do I help my mom? My mom had to try to give my dad CPR to get him alive, and she's calling me from Alabama. She's like, I can't, you know, he's dying. And it's something that you never want to have happen. But because I'd had this training ahead of me, I'd had this spiritual experience that happened slowly, and I didn't know I was tapping into it, but all those other actions, you know, showing up for my stepkid and showing up for other women in AA and showing up for family when it was inconvenient and trying to mend those bridges, it led all up to a point where I had a decision that God either is or he isn't. What is my choice to be? And I had to choose that there was a God. I had to choose this happened for a reason. See, he had a heart attack when I was 17 years old, and my reaction to that was to move to Santa Barbara. I don't know how to deal with things. I don't know how to deal with those kind of life stuff. That's something that I'm not capable of. But I got years of gravy with this man where I got to be a witness to my father, and he got to witness me as his daughter. And I got to stand there with my head held high, a woman of dignity and grace, a lot like the person that stands in front of you today, you know, because I am nothing without that spiritual experience. I am nothing. Like, I don't have any sustainable reflexes without having done this footing. And so it gave me that strength to be able to be there and shake hands when people, because they want to talk to you at funerals, and I don't know how to do that. And And I learned a lot at that point, and I made a decision, and I had a spiritual experience that there was no white light. I realized I'd already had it. I'd already had it moving chairs. I'd already had a spiritual experience by doing the fire drill that we do every single day here in meetings. I'd already had a spiritual experience by with these fluorescent freaking lights. And, you know, and being a good person who was like, well, I can't, this is going to sound really tenuous, but I went to go park. I went to go park the other day, and the only spots that were available were the ones for the liquor store. Okay, well, I don't care about that, but I wasn't going to a liquor store. I was going to the store next to it. But there's only one there for that. See, I can't really lie about that crap today. So I, like, waited for a while, and there weren't any other spots. And so I was like, this is getting really irritating. So I parked in the liquor store spot, walk in the liquor store, and I said, is it okay if I leave my car here while I do this 10-minute thing next door? And the guy's like, you want to park your car right there? And I was like, yes, can I please? And he's like, well, you asked me, and that's okay with me, so you can park your car there anytime you want. Like, you can do that anytime. Like, you are welcome to park in that spot. And I was like, so that is the, and you know, like I said, it's very tenuous, but I'm able to stand up in front of you and have my head held high, dignity and grace. I know you're not there yet, but not you, Richard, you. It's time for me to wrap up, but there's one thing I really have to say that's very important is that moving down here to San Diego was really difficult for me, but I found an amazing sponsor who really taught me how to be one with the women here. I decided to date this guy in Alcoholics Anonymous down here, which apparently had the worst reputation of anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, which will really alienate you from other women if you really want to give that a whirl. And but sometimes God gives you a clean slate. And what happened is this guy got a clean slate with me, and I get the opportunity to really treat me with dignity and respect like I deserve to be treated, you know? And I get a lot of side eyes, and I'm like, I know. But but no, sometimes God gives you things that are really sweet. And, you know, I'm going to stop on time. That's really important. But I just really want to welcome the new people and congratulate the people who had birthdays tonight and who took tokens tonight. Encourage you all to please keep coming back. Thank you.